Good morning. This morning's sermon is not exactly as advertised, but it is based on an idea earlier, because I'm not going into the pagan roots and origins of May Day. I'm going into what happened on May Day and the day without immigrants and what that means and what the complex issues around our hypocrisy, both left and right, about illegal immigrants or undocumented workers or casual ambassadors or whatever names we want to use, that also reveal a lot about our own attitudes. I have to admit that I had some anxiety about the May Day demonstrations, whether first presented as a boycott to show what the economic clout of the undocumented workers was about. I was afraid because the first one had been so successful and had really interrupted the flow of Sensenbrenner's senseless and heartless idea of expelling 12 million human beings, that in a sense the battle was won. Not the war, but the battle was won. And I had a great deal of anxiety that something would go wrong, that there would be agent provocateurs or just hotheads that would cause the impression to change, but it didn't. And I have to tell you, I was thrilled. I was thrilled by the people in the streets. I was thrilled that there were not agent provocateurs, apparently, and if there were, they were not successful. That the rhetoric was, for the most part, pretty mild and pretty straight. People talking about, we're here to work. It's a very interesting, difficult, and complex issue about immigration and illegal immigration and how we both encourage it, tolerate it, and then regret it when we start to get scared. I thought that the whole day went just like the song, De Colores. There were colors, there were people, there were flags, yes, and bandanas, and people, because not all Hispanics are monochromatic, there were people of every color involved, and it was, to, in some ways, America at its best. It was free speech, it was dissent, it was speaking some truth to power, because there's been very little truth spoken in the media about what the real issues are. There has been fear-mongering and hate speech. I have to tell you that on no issue have I, as a journalist, received more venomous hate mail. Mail that is absolutely fierce, angry, and racist. Now, I understand that Hispanic is not a race, but we deal with race and ethnicity and class in this country in a very confused and confusing manner. And the rhetoric that I have seen has been that kind of dehumanizing. They are scum, they are vermin, they are brown. Because when we are talking about the immigration problem in the United States, that's a code word. We are talking about Hispanics. We are not talking about all those Canadians that come in here and get all of our good jobs. We are not talking about Arnold, who comes in and takes the job of governor from a real American, Bustamante. We're not... Someday that line will not get a laugh. And I look forward to the day when that line will not get a laugh. Because when my daughter-in-law, Soo Yun, gets asked, well, do you have an American name? Why is Soo Yun less American than Sue? I mean, aren't we all immigrants?
As long as she's not a boy.
As long as she's not a boy. Don't make me start to sing. You'll regret it. I'll regret it. The movement will regret it. The whole issue has so much to do with what we perceive as race and class and culture. Because, truthfully, people are not worried about all of those Eastern Europeans who are coming in here, or all of those Canadians, or all of any other group. So if we're going to speak about it, let's speak about Hispanics and at least have an honest conversation. And there are lots of issues around which reasonable and good people can disagree. If you're sitting in your neighborhood and you see the signage change and all of a sudden you don't know what the store is selling, I understand that that's anxiety producing. If you're sitting in your neighborhood and that sign, those signs change from English to Spanish or Urdu or Thai, or down in Anaheim, Arabic, I understand the sense of being disoriented, of saying, there goes the neighborhood. The neighborhood has been going since the first pilgrims got here. And the Indians said, there goes the neighborhood, and of course in their case they were right. Think about the disorientation just in New York City at the turn of the last century. As good Americans, meaning English and German, were seeing their signage change into Hebrew letters spelling out Yiddish words, into Cyrillic alphabets, into Polish, seeing even their own precious alphabet changed into Italian, and these people were horrified at the them. Well, a lot of our grandparents and great-grandparents, and some of us are, realize that they were them. There are a lot of the children and descendants of thems in this room. And most of the thems, those Jewish, Italian, Irish, Polish, became us, Americans. And while I understand the natural apprehension as culture changes, as signage changes, as the number one condiment goes from ketchup to salsa, I know how everybody's so threatened by that. We have always been a mestizo country, a Creole country, one that has tried to take the best and sometimes the worst of every culture and put it together in our own kind of mix. It's the formulation of Creole cooking. It is the formula of jazz. It is the combining of the traits of all of the people who came here. And yet when the conversation comes up specifically about Hispanics, you would think from the email that I get and from the talking, screaming, shouting heads on cable television and on radio that this is another Katrina, that the levees have broken, the federal government has failed us, and a sea, a flood tide, a slow-moving tsunami of brown people have come in here taking away good jobs from real Americans. There's some truth certainly to the failure at the borders, and there are legitimate security issues around the control of our borders. But you know something? First of all, water seeks its level, and this has been going, as it did in Katrina, to the lowlands, to the lowest paying jobs, to the lowest sectors of society. And the irony, the compelling irony has been that those most affected by illegal immigrants, those most displaced economically, are not the ones making the most noise and being involved in the most venomous hate speech. The people who are making the most noise are the comfortable and the very comfortable. There are legitimate issues at the lower quartile of our society why people should have issues and questions about it, but that's not where the noise, the pain, and the venom is being expressed. But there's more to it than that. Decent people have always sought better for their families, for their children. That's how everybody got here. I'm sorry, there's an exception. Except for the slaves who were brought against their will on slave boats, the rest of this country, including the Native Americans, came because things were not going so well at home for themselves and for their families. Decent people seek something better. And walls have never been successful at keeping people out. Ask the Chinese about their Great Wall. It's a great wall. It's a really great wall. It is the only thing that you can actually see unaided from space of things that human beings have built. And it didn't keep out the invaders. Ask the Eastern Germans how well that wall worked to keep people in and to keep ideas out. The poet said, something there is that does not love a wall. There are legitimate security issues, but immigration is not going to be solved by walls, and it certainly is not going to be solved by these threats that are dangerous, hate speech, dehumanizing threats that talk about, well, let's deport 12 million brown-skinned people. There's a really good name for that that we all know. It's called ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing does not mean genocide. Ethnic cleansing means when you sweep out a population because of its religion, its perceived race, or its ethnicity. There are not migra sweeps planned for Canadians and Eastern Europeans. It's not going to happen. I'm not truly concerned that it would happen, but I am deeply embarrassed that it seems to be a legitimate conversation, that people are not ashamed of themselves for talking about how can we move 12 million people. And to say that, okay, they're here illegally, they've broken the law, shouldn't they be sent away? That's an abstract conversation. They're here. Their children, if they were born here, are Americans. We're going to separate those families. Those are family values. We're going to do it on the basis of their ethnicity. And what it does is it creates the presumption of second-class citizenship and status to anyone with brown skin. Because if you're rounding up 12 million people based on their skin color, the legal people who are here who are on that shade and spectrum are going to become suspect. Many of you know who read my second book that the most embarrassing experience of my life was sitting on a train and watching Migra come through that train and demand ID only from brown-skinned people. I would have had no objection if everybody had been asked to show ID. But when the color of your skin is probable cause to be stopped and to be treated differently, that is un-American. Well, it's historically American, but it's un-American according to our values, and it is wrong. We've got to be able to talk about the sensitive issues. We've got to be able to talk about the fact that we don't have control over borders and that, yes, water seeking its level, probably 75% of the world would like to be here. So what do? We throw our hands up and we go, oh my goodness, we either have to deport them or we're going to drown. That's silly. There are so many nuanced things that we can do that we won't talk about because there is such an overabundance of hypocrisy, both right and left. So I'm going to assume that I've got to offend almost everybody here. But let's start with the right. And that's the right wants to deport and is as addicted to cheap labor as we are addicted to oil. Agribusiness cannot survive without undocumented aliens. Again, this means brown-skinned people. Many of our industries and our sweatshops cannot survive without Asians and Hispanics, mostly Hispanics these days. And so we have massive businesses that depend on illegal aliens, undocumented workers, casual immigrants to get the work done. Then we have on the liberal side, where liberals love Hispanics, except really don't want to pay Social Security or minimum wage or health benefits, but we love them. Cheap love. Cheap love. And it's a different kind of addiction. America needs to come to terms with something. If we had a Migra rapture and all those brown-skinned people without documentation were taken away, we would have an economic collapse of unprecedented proportions. White single-parent families could not go to work if they had children. Meals would be unprepared, children unsupervised, lawns unmowed. An infinite number of service jobs in the lower eighth of our economy would go unfilled. So do we bemoan it? Do we panic? Do we scream? Do we build walls? Do we demand foolproof ID? I think one thing that you do is that you punish the end user, the agribusiness and the sweatshops that are not employing but exploiting these workers. You want to solve the problem? The problem really, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. You make every worker get the minimum wage just to start, and health benefits and Social Security, and you will find that the jobs at the lowest sub-minimum wage are going to dry up. People do not come to this country swimming rivers, climbing through barbed wire, and crossing deserts to go on welfare. They come here to work. If we paid decent wages, the balance would change. If we really enforced workplace sanctions, things would change very quickly. But here's the danger. The danger is what I call the Abu Ghraib danger, which is prisoners are tortured and privates and corporals are tried and punished. And it doesn't go to the colonels and to the major generals and to the generals and to the Secretary of Defense. So what inevitably would happen with worker sanctions is the nanny, the gardener, the server, this would get their employers would get nailed and tried and humiliated and fined. Start with employers that employ more than 10 or 15 or 20 and put real and strong sanctions on that. Make them pay minimum wage. There are ways of doing this that elevate both the conversation and the situation of our illegal, undocumented immigrants. The most important part of all of this for me, and the thing that really touched me in good ways and bad ways, comparing the May Day manifestations and the hate mail that I received was just how irrational this conversation can make us. There are really important issues beneath it. I understand the anger of people who waited in line in Europe, in Africa, in the Middle East for 15 years waiting to come in, and how they feel about people who jumped the line. I understand their anger. I understand that that's not fair, and at some level it's not fair, although I point out to them that they were not standing in line to come here to wash my dishes and to mow my lawn. They were coming here to be entrepreneurs and to be professionals, and they have been displaced by very few illegals. But I understand it as an issue. There's lots of real stuff to deal with. The whole language business is an important thing. I mean, that we were having a discussion about whether or not George W. Bush sang the national anthem once in Spanish and therefore was a hypocrite for saying it should be sung in English. Boy, you want to talk about a distraction. I'd like to hear him sing it in English, actually. First of all, it's unsingable, so let's just start with that. Look, there are legitimate issues around language and culture. There are legitimate issues where you cannot find a nation that's truly multilingual, that is not trying to tear itself apart and using language as a way of separating people from each other. Canada is not a good example of a multilingual society that works, because they're at loggerheads. Belgium, the same. Switzerland is not a country with four languages. It's four countries and a federation. So there are legitimate issues about language and about what is the language of the United States. And we can have those conversations. But we are having conversations about the fate and a sense of respect for real human beings. 12 million Hispanics who may be here illegally, millions more Hispanics who are here legally and were here in California before many of us. We need to have conversations about all of our policies, but with some sense of kindness and respect. The issues are real. The failure of governments to do something about borders, to be non-hypocritical in terms of labor policies, those are real issues that need to be addressed, but they are not addressed by shouting, by screaming, by xenophobia, by any kind of hatred that is based on race, religion, or ethnicity. We are all in this together as a nation. And we will all hang together, or surely we will hang separately. May Day, I know some of the critics said, well, that's a communist, socialist holiday. They chose May Day because they're really subversive. It was a party. It was a celebration. Had I children at home, I would have taken them out of school. Yes, and the schools would have lost their per diem. I would have taken them out of school the way my father took me out of school for great social and historic events. Dodgers opening day in the L.A. Coliseum. Told me to stay home the first day that we sent John Glenn up in a ship, in the spaceship. This was an historic event that was worth seeing people shaking hands, saying hello. And the pennants and the bandanas and the flags and a sense of pride. That's a good thing. I didn't hear a lot of hate speech coming from the Hispanic side. I've heard the hate speech on the radio and in the mail. Elevate the conversation and understand that across the political spectrum and the spectrum of colors, that we are human beings with rights to be treated with inherent dignity. And if we are going to be treated and have our dignity recognized, we have to project some dignity in our part of the conversation too. That's the social contract.